This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Thunder Run, The Armored Strike to Capture Baghdad, by David Zucchino. Narrated by Richard Davidson and directed by Joanna Parker. This book is copyrighted 2004 by David Zucchino. This recording is copyrighted 2004 by Recorded Books. This book commences with a foreword by Mark Bowden. By far the most important and decisive part of the stunning American sweep of Iraq in 2003 was the surprise armored thrust into the heart of Baghdad. While pundits at home and around the world, myself included, were predicting a potentially bloody, protracted siege of Saddam Hussein's capital, and while the notorious Baghdad Bob was before microphones in the Al-Rashid Hotel denying that American forces were anywhere near the city, the Spartan Brigade, the 2nd Brigade of the 3rd Infantry Division, mechanized, was blasting its way up the city's central avenues. It was a perfect illustration of how history is usually made, not by planners and critics, but by brave men with their boots on the ground, or, in this case, Abrams tank treads. The Spartan Brigade's Thunder Run became the turning point of the war, both militarily and psychologically. Watching on TV, many of us had the impression that Baghdad's resistance just melted away at the approach of American forces. Thunder Run will dispel that illusion. This was the most bitterly contested moment in the war, one that left thousands dead, including some very brave American soldiers. Zook's writing captures the drama, the heroism, the fear, noise, confusion, horror, and, yes, the thrill of battle. It is a masterwork by a master reporter and writer. I'm proud to introduce it to you. The author opens with the following quote from War and Memories by Stephen Crane. War is neither magnificent nor squalid. It is simply life, and an expression of life can always evade us. And now, Thunder Run.
Chapter 1. Charlie 1-2. Jason Diaz was worried about his tank. It had taken a terrible beating on the long, swift march up from Kuwait that spring. Roving packs of Fedayeen Saddam, the fanatic Iraqi militiamen in their distinctive black pajamas, had shot it up outside the holy city of Najaf and in firefights along the muddy Euphrates River. The tank's pale tan skin was peppered with holes, gouged out by automatic rifle fire and exploding grenades, leaving a splatter pattern of dinks and scrapes and blisters, like a chronic case of acne. The 1,500-horsepower turbine engine had sucked in several pounds of coarse sand and grit. The groaning twin tracks had been ground down by 2 weeks of firefights and ambushes as Diaz pushed the tank ruthlessly over the hardpan deserts of southern and central Iraq. He and his crew had been on the move, day and night, for 2 weeks, and he badly needed a day, or at least a few hours, for maintenance and repairs and sleep. Diaz was a tank commander, and his life depended on his tank. It was literally a mobile home for Diaz and his three crewmen, his gunner, his loader, and his driver. They slept on the decks, wolfed down lumpish MREs, meals ready to eat, inside the turret, hunkered down in the cramped hutches on cold desert nights. The tank's thick steel hull kept them alive. They had stayed buttoned up inside as RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades, exploded with heavy metallic jolts that made the cupola shudder, and as AK-47 rounds beat a steady ping, ping, ping on the 2-inch-thick steel ballistic skirts. Diaz loved its squat, ugly frame, its bull-shouldered arrogance, even the rank, sulphurous stench that permeated the turret each time the aft caps blew off the main gun rounds. The tank was a 70-ton gas hog, getting a mere 1 kilometer per gallon, highway or city. It burned 56 gallons an hour at full clip and 10 gallons an hour while idling. But for all its inefficient bulk, the tank was a $4.3 million killing machine. It was capable of ripping men in half with its coax. Its coaxially mounted 7.62-millimeter machine gun, and popping off enemy tank turrets 3 kilometers away with long, sleek rounds from its 120-millimeter main cannon. It was a mobile armory, hauling 41 main gun projectiles, 1,000 fat rounds of 50-caliber ammunition, and more than 10,000 7.62-millimeter machine gun bullets. Pitted against an Iraqi army with 3-decade-old Soviet tanks, the big pale beast seemed virtually invincible. The M1A1 Abrams was designed for brutal conditions, and this particular model was a mule. It looked like a junkyard wreck by now, on this cool evening in central Iraq, but it had brought Diaz and his crew all the way from the Kuwaiti desert to the dull gray plain south of Baghdad. The entire 2nd Brigade of the 3rd Infantry Division, mechanized, all 4,000 tankers and infantrymen and medics and mechanics, was camped out 18 kilometers south of the capital on a grimy stretch of scrub flatlands in the shadow of a soaring highway cloverleaf. The division had just completed the fastest sustained combat ground march in American military history. 704 kilometers in just over 2 weeks, and 300 kilometers in one 24-hour sprint. It was April 4th, 2003, and Jason Diaz from the Bronx, budding army lifer, husband of Monique, father of little Alondra and the twins, Alexandra and Anthony, was weary and filthy and longing to go home. But now, on this cold, starry night, he was obliged to demand even more from his exhausted crew and his overextended tank. He had just been ordered to take them straight into Baghdad. Diaz had received the OPORD, the operation order, in the dark that night. At his level in the chain of command, a mere staff sergeant in charge of just 3 men, he was provided no computer printout, no written battle plan. His platoon lieutenant simply called him over and said with little elaboration, "We're going into Baghdad at first light." Then the lieutenant felt compelled to add, unnecessarily, Diaz thought, "Be ready for a fight." The whole tank battalion was going, all 30 tanks and 14 Bradley fighting vehicles and assorted armored personnel carriers of the Desert Rogues, more formally known as the 1st Battalion, 64th Armor Regiment, which formed the core of Task Force 164. And Diaz's well-traveled tank, part of the lead platoon of Charlie Company, would be squarely in the middle of the armored column. Diaz was surprised by the sudden operation order, for there hadn't been the slightest hint that the brigade was going anywhere near downtown Baghdad. No American forces had entered the city. The war's main front was still well south of the capital, where the Medina Division of the Republican Guard was defending the southern approaches. In fact, Diaz and the rest of the battalion had spent most of that day foraging south, blowing up Medina Division tanks and personnel carriers on a sort of combat joyride that some of the tankers were now calling the Turkey Shoot. Long before LDing, before crossing what soldiers called the line of departure from Kuwait into Iraq 16 days earlier, Diaz and his men had been told that they would stop short of Baghdad. The 2nd Brigade, nicknamed the Spartan Brigade, was a heavy armor unit. The tankers had trained to fight in open desert, not in a city. The U.S. military strategy, as it had been briefed to Diaz at least, was to surround Baghdad with tanks, while airborne units cleared the capital block by block in a steady, constricting siege. The Pentagon brass was still spooked by the disastrous U.S. raid into Mogadishu 10 years earlier, when American soldiers were trapped in tight streets and alleys and 18 men were killed by Somali street fighters. But now, with no warning and with only a few hours to prepare, Diaz was being ordered to take his banged-up tank into a hostile city of 5 million Iraqis, a treacherous urban battlefield of narrow streets and alleyways. The mechanics worked on the tanks all that night. There were 4 tanks in Diaz's platoon, and 2 of them were in worse shape than his. They had debilitating track and battery problems. In fact, they were so degraded that the mechanics couldn't get them battle-ready. They were scratched from the mission in the middle of the night. The platoon would have to go into the city at half strength. Diaz had been up all night with the mechanics, and now he was too agitated to sleep. He didn't know anything about Baghdad. He didn't know anything about the enemy in the city. He wasn't afraid of combat or the enemy. He was afraid of the unknown. On the same barren field, Eric Schwartz was also having a fitful night. Schwartz was a short, spare, 41-year-old, the son of a Navy Huey gunship pilot who had won a Silver Star in Vietnam. With his clipped graying hair and studious manner, he looked more like a college professor than a soldier. He had a degree in education and a graduate degree in human resource development. Like most tankers, he was neither tall nor heavy set. Trim, compact men fit more comfortably in the tight hatches. Schwartz had fought as a tank commander in Operation Desert Storm, and now, 12 years later, he'd risen to battalion commander. A lieutenant colonel, he was the man in charge of the rogue battalion. And now he was trying to make it through what was becoming the longest night of his life. Schwartz had wrapped up the planning sessions for the mission at about 11:30 p.m. He walked out in the dark and climbed up on the deck of his tank to try to sleep. He stretched out there for a while, staring at the stars, his mind racing. And finally he gave up. He climbed down and strolled over to the tank crews. Nobody was sleeping. The tank commanders were talking quietly to their drivers and gunners, laying out details of the mission, their low voices like soft music in the dark. Schwartz went from crew to crew, patting backs, talking about families and food and home. He needed that human contact, and he thought his men did too. He kept at it for a couple of hours, then went back to his tank deck and tried again to fall asleep. This time, he went down. 30 minutes later, he woke up. It was nearly dawn. He was ready. Schwartz hadn't expected to be preparing to fight his way into Baghdad so soon. His focus had been in the opposite direction, more than 30 kilometers south of the capital, where his battalion had spent most of that day, April 4th, lighting up the Medina Division. This was the turkey shoot, what amounted to target practice, only with actual enemy tanks and armored personnel carriers instead of the rusted hulks the gunners had fired at on the target ranges in Kuwait and back home at Fort Stewart, Georgia. The Iraqis had hidden their outdated Soviet-made personnel carriers and tanks, T-55s and T-72s mostly, in garages, next to homes and schools, and in date palm groves. They were experts in camouflage, and much of the armor had survived coalition airstrikes. Many of the Iraqi regulars manning the vehicles had fled, so the rogue battalion was firing on quite a few empty tanks and personnel carriers that day. The battalion had absorbed a few stray RPG attacks and small arms rounds from Iraqi stragglers. But the biggest threat came not from the enemy, but from the hot, burning metal of exploding Iraqi vehicles. Abrams tanks normally fire at targets 2 or 3 kilometers away, the typical kill distance for the American tankers who had destroyed Iraqi tanks in the first Gulf War. But now, Rogue's targets were only a few hundred meters away, so close that the gunners could see the curling fronds on the date palm camouflage. As the Abrams tanks tore into the Iraqi armor, the tanks and personnel carriers exploded. They didn't just pop like firecrackers. They blew like bombs. The tank turrets spinning crazily and chunks of flaming steel and cooked ammunition hissing through the air. A shard of burning metal burned through one of Rogue's Humvee trailers, setting a heap of gear on fire. Several Americans were cut and bloodied by flying metal, none seriously. and the drivers quickly learned to speed up to escape the barrage. From his tank commander's hatch, Schwartz had spotted an empty T-72. He got on the radio and said, "This one is mine." He told his gunner to fire a sabot round, S-A-B-O-T. A 45-pound, armor-piercing projectile with aluminum-stabilizing fins and depleted uranium rod. An exceptionally dense metal, ideal for penetrating military armor and heating it to molten metal. The round easily punched through the tank's steel skin, but it didn't pop the turret. Schwartz ordered up a heat round, a high-explosive anti-tank projectile tipped with a shaped charge. It turned the T-72 into a bonfire. Schwartz's driver had to speed away to avoid the firestorm. But at one point, Schwartz got tagged. He was passing a burning Iraqi vehicle about 150 meters away, and he told his loader to keep an eye on it. It seemed ready to explode. An instant later, it blew. Schwartz felt a blast of heat and ducked down into the cupola. He popped back up to look around and was slammed down to the bottom of the turret. He briefly lost consciousness. His loader shook him roughly and shouted, "Sir! Sir! Sir! Get up! Get up!" Schwartz came to and looked at his shoulder. A hot shard of metal had smacked into it. The shard burned him and hurt like hell, but Schwartz was okay. He got back up in the turret and moved on. The shoulder was still aching later that afternoon when Schwartz got a radio call from Colonel David Perkins, the 2nd Brigade commander. Perkins wanted to see Schwartz right away at the brigade command tent. Schwartz had just finished the turkey shoot, and he and his men were beat. He'd hoped to give them time to rest, repair their vehicles, perhaps even grab a few hours' sleep. They had barely slept on the long slog up from Kuwait. Schwartz was a disciplined officer, and when his commander summoned him, he reported right away, no matter how tired and miserable he felt. A slight figure in his green Nomex tanker overalls, Schwartz hustled over to the command post at the edge of the dusty field along the highway. Inside, Perkins, a slender officer with an erect bearing, was hunched over a map, his head down. Normally, the command post was a loud, busy place, a collection of communications vehicles backed up end-to-end and covered with canvas. But now it was quiet, and the headquarters staff officers and battle captains were milling around, silent. Schwartz took off his helmet and flak vest. An officer cleared off the map board in front of Perkins. The icon showed 2nd Brigade's battalions clustered south of the city. The division's 1st Brigade camped to the west at the airport, and the 3rd Brigade set up northwest of the capital. A division of the U.S. Marines was still on the move southeast of the city, off the map. Baghdad itself was a blank expanse of enemy forces, size and capability unknown. Perkins looked up. "At first light tomorrow," he told Schwartz, "I want you to attack into Baghdad." Schwartz heard a whooshing noise in his ears. He felt disoriented. He had just spent several hours in a tank, pushing south, ducking hot shrapnel, and the last thing on his mind was going north into Baghdad. He had always assumed airborne units would clear the capital at some future date, with the Spartan Brigade setting up blocking positions outside the city. "Are you fucking crazy?" Schwartz blurted out, then added, "Sir?" He waited for the other officers to laugh. There was silence. "No," Perkins said. He wasn't the type of commander to kid around. "And I'm coming with you. We have to do this." Just after dawn the next morning, April 5th, the entire battalion was lined up on Highway 8, south of the Capitol. Engines gunning, weapons primed. The squat tan forms of the tanks and Bradleys bathed in gold morning light. Jason Diaz's tank, radio call sign Charlie 1-2, was 15th in the order of march. He was up in the commander's hatch, awaiting the order to move out, when his driver radioed up from the driver's hole, tucked below the turret. "The air filter clogged light is on," he said. They hadn't even launched the mission yet, and already the tank was balking. Dias was anxious enough, and now this. He climbed down to check it out and saw his platoon leader, First Lieutenant Roger Gruneisen, inspecting his tank. The lieutenant's right track was damaged, and the cooling tubes were worn. Every time the track turned a rotation, it made a horrible clanking sound. Gruneisen looked at Dias and asked, "You think we'll make it?" Though Dias was an enlisted man and Gruneisen was an officer, Dias had more experience as a tank commander. He didn't want to lie. "Really, sir," he said, "I'm not sure." And that was the honest truth. Dias respected the lieutenant too much to try to bullshit him. Gruneisen was a platoon leader who trusted his men and let them do their jobs. He was the kind of man that Dias, a Latino from the Bronx, probably never would have known if he hadn't joined the military. Gruneisen was a white southerner, a pale young 24-year-old with a shaved head and a soft Kentucky twang. He was a West Point man, focused and resolute, commissioned less than 2 years earlier. Dias, 27, had already put in 8 years and was thinking about becoming an Army lifer. He drifted aimlessly after graduating from John F. Kennedy High in the Bronx, working odd jobs in Puerto Rico before wandering into an Army recruiting station one day. The recruiter showed him videos of various military MOSs, or specialties, medic, personnel, supply. Then he put on the tanker video. Dias saw the thermal sights and the computerized targeting system and all the other high-tech turret gadgets. He watched a tank pulverize targets, spitting out awesome bursts of orange fire from the main gun tube. He thought it would be cool to blow things up. He signed up to be a tanker. Dias had a deep affection for his current Abrams, which he'd trained on and fought in for the previous 6 months. He and his gunner, Sergeant Jose Couvertier, had nicknamed it Cojones, eh? The phrase had no literal English translation. Essentially, it meant, "Yeah, right, a skeptic's challenge." All the tankers had spray-painted their main cannons with leering names that suggested a particularly aggressive and retributive brand of patriotism. Apocalypse and Crusader. Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue. And Cry Havoc and Let Slip the Dogs of War. Charlie 1-2's nickname just happened to be more esoteric than most. Standing next to Dias on Highway 8, Gruneisen didn't seriously consider aborting his platoon's mission. They were only going 17 kilometers from their staging area south of the city, a straight shot north up Highway 8, and then west on 8, where the highway curved toward the International Airport. There, the battalion would link up with the division's 1st Brigade, which had seized the airport 2 days before, rechristening Saddam International as Baghdad International. This was an armored reconnaissance mission. Armor Recon was just what it sounded like. The battalion was to smash through Baghdad's defenses, drawing fire and shooting back in order to probe the Iraqis' defenses and tactics to determine, violently, how Saddam Hussein intended to defend his capital. It was Recon by fire. Gruneisen was surprised by Highway 8. It was a modern, divided superhighway, nothing like the rutted roads and sandy tracks the battalion had plowed through down south. It looked like an American interstate highway. From what he could see, it hadn't been badly damaged by coalition airstrikes. It was 2 lanes wide in some places, 3 in others. The lieutenant thought his ailing tanks could last 17 kilometers on that smooth, flat surface. He turned to Dias. "Let's give it a shot," he said, as if there were any alternative. Within minutes, the order came to mount up and move out. The column lurched to life. Foul black smoke erupted from the Bradley engines. The tank tracks tore neat little grooves in the asphalt, clanking and grinding, and the roadway was milky white with blowing dust. The lead tank chugged past the final American checkpoint, and a voice came over the radio net. "You are now entering Indian country." Diaz gave his driver the order to pull forward, with Grunizen on his wing. Already, they could hear the soft pop of small arms fire up ahead. They'd been in combat for the previous 16 days, off and on, but still they felt that tight, queasy spasm in their bellies that always rose up, urgent and bitter, just before a fight. It passed quickly, and Grunizen fell easily into the order of march. The final checkpoint was fading into the yellow dust behind them when the driver radioed the lieutenant that the oil filter warning light had suddenly started flashing. At the head of the column, First Lieutenant Robert Ball scanned the roadway, left to right, right to left, searching for threats. As the commander of the lead tank, he felt as though he were perched on a slow 70-ton target, especially standing up in the cupola, his head and shoulders exposed. He wore a CVC, a combat vehicle crew helmet, made of bullet-resistant Kevlar and a small tanker's flak vest. But he knew a single well-placed round from an assault rifle, so useless against a tank, was more than enough to kill him in an instant. Ball had been selected to lead the column not because he had a particularly refined sense of direction, but because his tank had a plow. The battalion was expecting obstacles in the highway. Like any motorist, Ball had been lost a time or two while driving in the States. Even so, he thought of himself as pretty good with a map, and he had carefully studied his 1 to 100,000 military map of Baghdad and Highway 8. He could see how the highway bent west toward the airport, cutting a slice through southwest Baghdad. But the map had no civilian markings, no exit numbers, no neighborhoods. Ball was concerned about missing his exit to the airport at what everybody called the Spaghetti Junction, a maze of twisting overpasses and on-ramps on the cusp of downtown Baghdad. He found himself longing for a simple AAA tourist map. Ball, 25, had never been in combat prior to the firefights in the southern Iraqi desert. He was a slender, soft-spoken North Carolinian, with a girlfriend back home and a twin brother in the service. He'd spent 2 years in the North Carolina Army Reserves before entering West Point and earning a commission in 2001. He'd been promoted to first lieutenant just 4 months earlier. And now he was a platoon leader in the same company that Rick Schwartz had commanded in the first Gulf War. Ball had killed a man for the first time a few days earlier. In fact, he and his crew had killed quite a few enemy fighters down south, and he found it an unnerving experience. He couldn't remember them all, but for certain ones he recalled the most curious details. The stunned look on the dying man's face, the smell, the hazy air, the intense emotional attachment to the intricate ballet of combat. He felt an abiding sense of regret, which he'd anticipated. He'd met with a chaplain in Kuwait several times, seeking reassurance. The chaplain had told him that killing the enemy was part of a just cause. It would actually save lives in the long run and improve the prospects of thousands of Iraqis. The little sessions with the chaplain had put Ball at ease, and now he was primed for the fight. Ball's map was clipped to the top of the commander's hatch, next to his 50-caliber machine gun, as he led the column up the highway. It was an unremarkable stretch of roadway. In the early morning light, everything was bathed in a monochrome grayish tan. The overpasses, the access roads, the squat houses, and multi-story apartment buildings set far off the highway. On either side were open stretches of packed dirt and dust-choked weeds, providing clear fields of fire. Ball had been rolling only a few minutes when his gunner, Sergeant Geary LaRoque, spotted the first targets of the morning. A dozen Iraqi soldiers in green uniforms were leaning against a building, chatting, drinking tea, their weapons propped against a wall. They were only a few hundred meters away, but they seemed oblivious to the grinding and clanking of the approaching armored column.
"Sir, can I shoot at these guys?"
LaRocque asked. The rules of engagement said anyone in a military uniform or brandishing a weapon was a legitimate target. They didn't say anything about announcing yourself before firing.
Yeah, their enemy," Ball replied.
In southern Iraq, the men Ball's crew had killed were murky green figures targeted at great distances by the tank's thermal imagery system. Their body heat gave them away, creating eerie human shapes on the thermals. But now these soldiers, highlighted against the dark building along Highway 8, were in living color. Through the tank's magnified sights, Ball could see their eyes, their mustaches, their steaming cups of tea. LaRocque mowed them down methodically, left to right. As each man fell, Ball could see a puzzled expression cross the face of the next man before he, too, pitched violently to the ground in a pink spray. The last man managed to flee around the corner of the building, but then, inexplicably, he ran back into the open. The gunner dropped him. The clattering of the tank's coax, its rapid-fire medium machine gun, seemed to awaken Iraqi soldiers posted up and down the highway. Gunfire erupted from both sides. AK-47 assault rifles and rocket-propelled grenades, followed minutes later by recoilless rifles and air defense artillery in direct fire mode. Ball was surprised by the sudden intensity of fire. He was accustomed to the way the Iraqis had fought down south, which was mostly pop-up, shoot, run, and hide. But now, on Highway 8, they were standing their ground, and the column had only traveled about a mile beyond the final checkpoint. Ball could now see that the Iraqis had built an elaborate network of trenches and bunkers on both sides of the highway. He saw bright white muzzle flashes, little sparks of light all the way up the shoulders of the highway. From alleyways and rooftops, men with RPGs were launching grenades toward the column. Flaming red balls of light trailed by spirals of gray smoke. The first main tank round of the mission was fired by Sergeant Jeffrey Ellis, an easygoing Alabamian who was the gunner on the third tank in the column. Ball had radioed back to Ellis that a group of armed men had just fired an RPG and then ducked into a tiny cinder block hut on the right side of the highway. He wanted them taken out. Sergeant First Class Ronald Gaines, the tank commander, radioed the company commander, Captain Andy Hilmes, and said, "We've got some guys running into a little building. Request permission to fire the main gun." Hilmes responded, "Roger. Fire main gun." Through his magnified sight, Ellis could see men piling into the hut. There were perhaps two dozen of them. The main gun was in battle carry mode, meaning it was preloaded, in this case with an MPAT round, a multipurpose anti-tank projectile. It was a new piece of ammunition that hadn't been used in combat before the Iraqi war. Ellis thought it was just as effective as a heat round and a little more versatile. When set to ground mode, it could also be used against helicopters. The MPAT was designed to penetrate a target and explode inside. Ellis traversed the gun tube, got a laser reading of 610 meters, and put the targeting reticle's tiny red crosshatches on the hut. He squeezed the trigger on the gunner's power control handles, which all the gunners called Cadillacs, for the original manufacturer, Cadillac Gauge. "On the way," he announced. The MPAT round reduced the hut to dust, unleashing a cloud of gray smoke twice the size of the structure. Even before the crews in the tanks behind him announced over the radio that nothing was moving inside, Ellis knew he'd killed them all. Over the net came calls of congratulations,
Great shot! Good shot! Hell of a shot!
Suddenly, trucks and pickups and taxis were speeding toward the overpasses from access roads, dropping off gunmen. They stood at the roadside, completely exposed, and fired AK-47s from the hip. Ball opened up with his 50-caliber machine gun, and the gunner unleashed the coax, tearing into the gunmen and sending them tumbling into the dirt. The tank gunner started lighting up the vehicles in fiery red explosions from heat rounds, and more heat and MPAT rounds tore into the roadside bunkers. The battle was on. In the command tank, a short distance behind Ball, the battalion commander, Rick Schwartz, was determined to keep the column moving. The last thing Schwartz wanted was to get pinned down or be drawn into an extended firefight. The night before, he had instructed his officers and NCOs to keep the convoy moving at 15 kilometers per hour, with strictly enforced 50-meter intervals between the vehicles. The drivers were under orders to keep a steady pace. Moving faster or slower would break the column and permit enemy vehicles to slice in and attack the tanks in their vulnerable rear exhaust grills. The track commanders and gunners had their own orders. The lead gunners were to try to kill everything they saw, then pass the targets back to the trailing tracks. Schwartz wanted his men talking to one another, describing exactly what they were shooting at and what still needed killing. Schwartz was still trying to determine exactly what he was up against. The brigade's S2 shop, the intelligence guys, hadn't been able to tell him much. In fact, when Schwartz had asked for specifics about enemy strength and positions the night before, he got a vague, long-winded answer. Finally, Schwartz said, "So you don't know shit about the enemy in the city, do you?" The intelligence officer told him, "No. Nothing, really." Nor were the intelligence officers entirely certain how badly coalition airstrikes had degraded Saddam Hussein's forces, what weapons the Iraqis had, or how determined they were to stand and fight. The brigade scouts, who normally went out ahead to conduct enemy surveillance, had not ventured north. It was too dangerous. And if any special forces teams had been in the city, Schwartz certainly didn't know what, if anything, they'd discovered. He was on his own. Schwartz did have satellite imagery providing a black-and-white, photographic, bird's-eye view of Baghdad. But the imagery was several days old, perhaps a week old or more. Even if it had been shot that morning, it wouldn't have told Schwartz where the enemy was dug in. Satellite imagery couldn't pick up camouflaged bunkers or RPG teams hiding in alleyways and second-story windows. The division had tried to order up a pass by a UAV, an unmanned aerial vehicle, a spy drone, for real-time battlefield photos. But for various bureaucratic and technical reasons, it never happened. To the best of Schwartz's knowledge, Highway 8 wasn't blocked by any concerted Iraqi attempt at barricades. The Iraqis certainly had not blown the bridges and overpasses leading into the capital, although American military planners had expected them to try. Based on the most recent satellite imagery and on reports from American pilots who'd flown over the city, the highway was clear and relatively unscathed by coalition airstrikes. There was no safer or faster surface for tanks than good old highway asphalt. In this case, asphalt helpfully marked with wide traffic lanes and highway signs in Arabic and English. By all indications, the Iraqis had left the back door to the capital wide open. It was like leaving Interstate 95 and the Capitol Beltway open for an enemy tank invasion of Washington, D.C. In issuing his order to Schwartz, Colonel Perkins had said, "The task is to enter Baghdad for the purpose of displaying combat power, to destroy enemy forces, and to simply show them that we can." Essentially, what Perkins had ordered up was a thunder run, a lightning-armored strike straight into the capital. The American military had been conducting thunder runs since the Vietnam War, where the term had originated. The secure artillery fire bases set up in Vietnam in the mid-1960s had been codenamed Thunder 1, Thunder 2, and so on. The Viet Cong, attempting to disrupt U.S. supply convoys plying the highways between the artillery bases, sent out guerrilla teams at night to cut the roads and set up ambushes. To keep the arteries secure, American commanders dispatched columns of tanks and armored vehicles up and down the roads at dusk. The columns moved at high speeds, blasting away on both sides of the highway to draw enemy fire, what the military calls recon by fire. Soon, any rapid dash through hostile territory became known as a thunder run. As the rogue column came under fire on the morning of April 5th, Schwartz got a good look at the enemy. There were hundreds of them, perhaps thousands. Some were in uniform. Some wore civilian clothes, or a mix of jeans and green army vests, with machine gun coils slung bandolier style over their shoulders. There were Fedayeen Saddam militiamen in baggy black pajamas and, Schwartz didn't realize this until later, Syrian mercenaries brought in by buses from Damascus, their pockets stuffed with Iraqi dinars. Many of the Syrians, along with armed Jordanians and Palestinians, were jihadis, Muslim fundamentalists eager to fight a holy war against infidel invaders. There was an armored personnel carrier here and there, but no tanks, and probably nothing capable of destroying a tank or Bradley. But the recoilless rifles could put a serious dent in an armored personnel carrier and were a real threat, especially to the combat engineers firing their M4 carbines from the exposed hatches of the M113 armored tracks. Schwartz had ordered the engineers to fire at snipers in upper-story windows or on rooftops. The tanks had trouble elevating their gun tubes that high. If any of his guys were going to get killed, he feared it would be the engineers. The Iraqis seemed to have no training, no discipline, no coordinated tactics. It was all point and shoot. A few soldiers would pop up and fire, then stand out in the open to gauge the effects of their shots. The big coax rounds from the tanks and Bradley sent chunks of their bodies splattering into the roadside. Nor did the Iraqis seem to appreciate the lethal and accurate firepower of the tanks and Bradleys. The gunmen fired from bunkers, their muzzle flashes exposing their positions. From hundreds of meters away, nearly out of sight, the tank gunners peered through their optical sights and fixed the red aiming dots and crossed hash lines of their reticles, their targeting systems, on the bunkers. They squeezed red trigger buttons on their Cadillacs, and the bunkers exploded with a heavy whoomp and a shudder as the heat rounds detonated. Few of the Iraqi fighters demonstrated much command of basic combat maneuvers. They would bunch up in the alleyways, firing wildly. The tank loaders would shove an MPAT round into the breech and set the proximity fuse for 10 or 12 meters. The gunners would fire into the mass of men, and the broad arc of the explosion would send their shattered bodies airborne. Gunmen crouched behind walls made of brick or cinder block, apparently unaware that not only the tanks and Bradleys, but also the tank commander's 50-caliber machine gun rounds could pound the walls to dust in seconds. The gunners watched the fighters' bodies explode and disintegrate, along with whole sections of the walls. Other fighters hid in thick stands of date palm trees, leaping out to launch RPGs. Some of the tank and Bradley gunners had discovered down south that a tree hit with a 50-pound shell unleashes a wave of flying wood shards. It was wood shrapnel. The gunners tore into the date palms along Highway 8, shattering the trunks and impaling anyone crouched behind them. The tanks and Bradleys had a rhythm now. Pounding, pounding, pounding. They were killing people by the dozens, but still the enemy kept coming. By now, gunmen were up on the overpasses, firing straight down on the tank and Bradley hatches. More and more vehicles were appearing. There were little Japanese sedans and bulky 1980s-era Chevrolet Caprices, some of them stuffed with husbands and wives and kids staring wide-eyed at the column as the car zoomed past in the southbound lanes beyond the median. But other cars and pickups were packed with soldiers in uniform or men in civilian clothes, blasting away with AK-47s poking out the windows. There were 10 military troop trucks and technicals, white Toyota pickups with machine guns or anti-tank rockets mounted in the beds. It occurred to the battalion's S3, the operations officer, Major Michael Donovan, that the battalion was winging it. They certainly had not trained for urban warfare, much less for this battle, which involved urban areas at the highway's margins, but also stretches of wide open cross-country highway. It was like fighting on the New Jersey Turnpike. Donovan, 38, a slender, sharp-featured man, was the son of a Vietnam veteran, a Citadel graduate, and a student of military history. It dawned on him now that Rogue Battalion was rewriting the Army's armor doctrine on the fly. He himself was certainly rewriting the role of an operations officer. His job was planning an organization, but now he was in the commander's hatch of an Abrams and firing an M4 carbine at men in ditches on the side of a superhighway. He thought, holy shit, I'm the S3 and I'm shooting dudes with a rifle. This was nothing like Donovan had experienced in Operation Desert Storm in southern Iraq a decade earlier. Back then, his tank never got closer than 2 kilometers to an Iraqi tank. That was a standoff war, distant, removed, impersonal. This war, Schwartz had warned him the night before, would be unique. This isn't going to be anything like Desert Storm. Now, on Highway 8, Donovan could see the faces of Iraqi fighters. His father had told him stories of Viet Cong guerrillas smiling as they fired. Now he was seeing young Iraqi faces, and their dominant emotion was fear. They looked terrified. Donovan spotted several armed soldiers in a bunker just beyond the guardrail. They were huddled and afraid. He didn't want to kill them, but he had to. They were the enemy. He opened up with the M4 and watched them topple. More carloads of civilians were beginning to appear, complicating what the tankers called target acquisition. Donovan was worried about civilian casualties, what the military, in its wonderfully clinical articulation, referred to as collateral damage. The civilians were getting into the middle of the fight. The crews were under strict orders to identify targets as military before firing. They were supposed to fire warning shots, then shoot into engine blocks if a vehicle continued to approach. Some cars screeched to a halt, others kept coming, and the gunners and tank commanders ripped into them. Some vehicles exploded, others smashed into guardrails, their windshields streaked with blood. The crews could see soldiers or armed men in civilian clothes in some of the smoking hulks. In others, they weren't sure. Deep down, they knew they were inadvertently killing civilians who had been caught up in the fight. They just didn't know how many. They knew only that any vehicle that kept coming at the column was violently eliminated. At one point, a white minivan sped alongside Donovan's tank. The driver, a middle-aged man in civilian clothes, made eye contact and gave Donovan a manic "don't shoot" gesture. Donovan motioned for him to get out of the way. As the van pulled away, Donovan saw that 3 uniformed soldiers with guns were lying in the rear bed. He radioed ahead to the front of the column. Minutes later, He watched one of the gunners with the fire support team pulverize the minivan as it tried to escape down an exit ramp. At the next interchange, Donovan spotted a technical, a red Nissan pickup with a Soviet-made heavy machine gun mounted in the truck bed. A young man was firing the gun at the column, his black hair blowing wildly as the Nissan sped across an overpass. Donovan screamed, "Oh, shit!" and yelled for the loader to open up with his M240 medium machine gun. Donovan fired his M4. They missed, and the technical got away. The technical vehicles worried Lieutenant Colonel Schwartz because the driver seemed so fearless and reckless. A few seemed determined to ram the column, driving straight toward the massive tanks and Bradleys before the coax rounds shattered their windshields and sent the vehicles careening into the guardrails. Schwartz was worried, too, about anti-tank weapons. He thought he'd spotted a couple of American-made TOW missiles, tube-launched, optically-tracked, wire-guided missiles. Lethal weapons designed to destroy armored vehicles, including American tanks and Bradleys. Still, he felt confident. The lead tracks were radioing back to other tracks, giving them triggers to prepare to fire on technicals speeding up from the rear flanks. Schwartz's air liaison officer was in his ear all morning, radioing with updates from the Air Force pilots circling overhead, tracking technicals and trucks pouring in from the crowded neighborhoods on either side of the highway. The column was moving steadily. Nobody was stopping or even slowing. The tracks were passing on targets, handing off, just as Schwartz had ordered. Every single vehicle in the column had been blistered by RPGs or recoilless rifle rounds and thousands of rounds of small arms, but everybody was still intact and moving. Some of the RPGs had detonated on the gear and rucksacks stored on the track's external bustle racks, and now the stuff was on fire. Most of the crews just let it burn. Schwartz was laying down suppressive fire with his .50 caliber, shouting into his radio microphone. He was repeating himself now, but he wanted his message drummed into his soldiers' brains. "Pass 'em off. Pass 'em back. Keep moving. Keep the momentum." The column, still intact, still paced and measured, rumbled up Highway 8. The staff officers back at the brigade operations tent could mark its progress on their computer screens, the column represented by tiny blue icons that inched, slowly, inexorably, north toward Baghdad. Chapter 2. The Right Thing. As their tank approached the final checkpoint on Highway 8, Lieutenant Grüneisen's crew was blasting the heavy metal song Creeping Death by Metallica on speakers inside the turret. They'd nicknamed their Abrams Creeping Death because they all loved the song, which they thought evoked something sinister and lethal. That's how they felt going in that morning. Even so, the mood was oddly buoyant inside the turret. Buoyant, but also focused and determined, with just a whiff of sweaty anxiety. The crewmen always cranked up the music going into a mission to jack them up, to blow away the butterflies and get them in the mood to destroy the enemy. It seemed to the crew's gunner, Sergeant Carlos Hernandez, that they had been killing people for a long time, even though it had been barely 2 weeks. Hernandez had never been at war before, but he discovered down south that time slowed down in combat. So many things happened all at once that it was almost as though time had to somehow pause and expand in order to accommodate it all. This enabled Hernandez to recall with utter clarity what it was like to kill a man. After the very first time, outside Najaf, he was pumped up and mournful at the same time. That conflicted feeling stayed with him even after he'd killed a few more people. But after a while, he just got numb. Other guys in his company had different reactions. Once, Also outside Najaf, they were pounding an Iraqi bunker complex with tank cannons when they saw an Iraqi soldier leap up, throw down his weapon in disgust, and stalk off. The man had almost escaped the kill zone when an American mortar crashed down right on top of him, a direct hit. The soldier's body disintegrated. Everybody laughed. Not necessarily at the man's brutal death, but at fate. And how a guy who'd decided to just walk away from a fight got nailed anyway. Hernandez had thought a lot about death back in Kuwait. He was Catholic. Not exactly a churchgoer, but enough of a Catholic to be familiar with the phrase, "Thou shalt not kill." He had sought out the battalion chaplain in Kuwait, for he wanted to make sure he was right with God in case he had to kill somebody. He and the chaplain had three or four good heart-to-heart sessions. Hernandez asked why people went to death row in the real world for murder, but got medals in war for killing other human beings. The chaplain told him it boiled down to good and evil, and evil had to be conquered. Hernandez asked how the Iraqis justified killing to their God, their Allah. The chaplain sidestepped the question and told him that Saddam Hussein was evil and had killed thousands of his own people. Ending his regime would save lives. He reassured Hernandez and said, "You're doing the right thing." Hernandez decided then that he was going to do whatever was necessary to keep his crew alive and to get everybody back home safely, himself included. 27 years old, he was a family man these days, far removed from the restless, drifting kid he'd been after he dropped out of high school in Tampa to work as a carpenter on a construction crew. Joining the army had given him structure, and marrying Kimberly, his high school sweetheart, had settled him down. If he had to kill somebody to get home safely to Kimberly and his little boy, Carlos Anthony, and his daughter, Louise Marie, that's what he would do. As soon as the tank crossed the checkpoint on Highway 8, the crew killed the music. The lieutenant shouted, "Test fire weapons!" And Hernandez fired a few bursts of coax, which relaxed him and reassured him that everything was going to be okay. Then he heard the driver tell Lieutenant Grunheisen that the oil filter light was on. He radioed his buddy in Charlie 1-2, Jason Diaz. Hernandez and Diaz and their wives played dominoes together back at Fort Stewart and told him, "Man, this doesn't look too good." Then the crews heard Lieutenant Ball's radio voice at the head of the column announce, "Contact!" The gunmen in the bunkers opened up on them, and the crew got straight into the fight. Up in the turret of Charlie 1-2, Diaz started working the .50 caliber, pumping rounds into the bunkers and into technical vehicles trying to race up the on-ramps and onto the overpasses. His gunner was hosing down dismounts, foot soldiers, with the coax, keeping them away from the column. Diaz feared dismounts would try to get close enough to the tank to pitch a grenade down the turret. They were approaching the first overpass when Diaz felt a concussion rock the tank. He was wearing his CVC helmet, which muffled even the ear-splitting booms of the 120-millimeter main tank cannons, but still he could feel a shock wave washing over the turret. It felt like the concussion from a main gun, and he thought that perhaps Lieutenant Grunheisen, in Charlie 1, Creeping Death, had pulled too close to him and fired over his back deck. Diaz radioed the lieutenant and asked whether he had fired his main gun. "Negative," Grunheisen said. "Can you look at my rear and see if anything's smoking?" The air was black with smoke from burning vehicles and bunkers and the exhaust from the Bradleys. Grunheisen couldn't see much. Diaz's tank seemed fine. "Keep going," he told Diaz. Moments later, Grunheisen heard his ammo loader, Private First Class Donald Schaefer, say, "Sir, something has hit 1-2. Grunheisen looked again and saw a trail of gray smoke snaking from the rear grill. Some sort of fluid was dripping underneath the tank. Inside Charlie 1-2, Private First Class Chris Shipley shouted to Diaz from the driver's hole,
"The fire warning light's on!" And then, "The emergency lights are on!"
The whole driver's control panel was flashing. Diaz was reporting the malfunction over the company net just as Grunison radioed and told him,
"It looks like something hit you in the back, right above the grill."
Diaz wanted to keep going and try to hobble all the way to the airport, but then Shipley radioed again from the driver's hole.
"The tank just aborted."
The engine shut down. They were slowing to a stop. Diaz didn't want to stop under the overpass and expose the stricken tank to enemy fire from above. He willed the tank forward, shouting at Shipley to try to keep it moving long enough to clear the overpass. They rolled on and came to a rest just north of the bridge, in the far left lane of Highway 8. Diaz looked at his rear deck. Orange flames were shooting up out of the grill. He couldn't believe it. He had never pictured an Abrams tank as helpless, as a victim. The entire brigade had had just one tank disabled by enemy fire in the entire war. 2 days earlier, a fire in a tank's auxiliary power unit, triggered by an RPG hit, had been quickly put out and the tank recovered and repaired. Even under punishing conditions and chronic parts shortages, the brigade had lost only 15% of its tanks to repairs at any given time. But now the back of Charlie 1-2 looked like a little bonfire. Diaz cursed and gave the order for the fire drill, the same drill they had practiced endlessly at Fort Stewart and in the Kuwaiti desert. He tried to sound calm as he hollered, "Evacuate tank!" The defining characteristic of combat is chaos. No operation plays out the way it was planned. The purpose of training is to bring order to chaos, to condition men to react in prescribed ways no matter what the emergency. On Highway 8, the battalion's training kicked in. Diaz's crew evacuated the tank and took up fighting positions. Grunison pulled his tank forward to protect the stricken tank's northern flank. The Charlie Company commander, Captain Jason Conroy, moved his tank ahead of Grunison's to provide more combat power, and the trail platoon set up a perimeter of armored vehicles to protect the rear. Diaz and his crewmen were now exposed. It was a shock to be down on the smoky highway, out of the protective cocoon of the tank and its thick steel hull. The air smelled of cordite and burning fuel. It stung their nostrils. The crewmen heard rounds pinging off the sides of the tank and realized they were under fire. Gunmen in the crease of the overpass, where the bridge abutment meets the underside of the elevated runway, were firing down on them. Shipley, the driver, had fired so many M4 carbine rounds that he was out of ammunition. He saw an AK-47 on the roadway, picked it up, and got it to work. He was firing away toward the overpass when one of the tanks traversed and cut down the gunman in the crease with a burst of coax. The tank fire was behaving strangely now. When Charlie 1-2 aborted, its fire protection system kicked in automatically, spraying the fire with halon, a chemical retardant designed to rob flames of oxygen. That doused the fire for a moment, but soon it came back to life. Diaz jumped down to the left side of the tank and yanked the red emergency fire handle, setting off another round of halon. The fire smoldered. While his crew laid down suppressive fire, Diaz got on the back deck and inspected the rear grill. He opened up the rear compartments and saw that all the V-packs, ventilation filters made of aluminum and filter paper with stiff accordion-like folds, were on fire. In the lower compartments, the tank's batteries were melting. Fuel was pouring onto the highway. It was bad, and Diaz knew it. But he also knew an Abrams was nearly invincible, and the only other brigade tank to catch fire in Iraq had been rescued with minimal damage. He heard a whooshing sound. An RPG screamed over his head and slammed into the roadway beyond the median in a flash of sparks and flame. Diaz hollered for somebody to toss him his M4 carbine. He grabbed it and squeezed off several rounds at a bunker on the left side of the highway a few hundred meters to the northwest. He could see muzzle flashes, and he knew the gunmen inside had a clear shot at the tank. They were well concealed in a series of trenches next to a low wall. Diaz's eyes burned, and his throat was raw from harsh chemicals released by the flames. He jumped off the back deck and got his first look at the rear engine housing. Something had left a perfect hole the size of a quarter in the shock housing and punctured the right rear fuel cell in the back of the tank, where the protective steel is only about a quarter inch thick above the number 6 skirt. The projectile went straight through the hull. It was a 1-in-a-million shot, probably a recoilless rifle, Diaz thought. The projectile had to have been fired from below to enter at such a low angle. Diaz had seen recoilless rifles in alleyways, firing up at the elevated roadway, but he never imagined a round from one could actually stop an Abrams. And yet, if they could extinguish the fire, Diaz thought, they could tow the tank the rest of the way. He grabbed the tank's handheld fire extinguishers and doused the flames. The fire went out, then erupted again. Diaz didn't know it, but fuel was pouring onto the tank's superheated turbine engine, bursting into flames each time the previous fires were snuffed out. Even after tank engines are shut down, they remain hot for a considerable time. By now, the delay was affecting the entire mission. It took a minute or two for word of the disabled tank to move up and down the column, but soon the entire battalion was stopped, spread out, and exposed. In his tank, Lieutenant Colonel Schwartz was listening on the radio to events unfolding at the Cloverleaf, growing more anxious by the moment. This was the last thing he wanted, to lose momentum, to get bogged down in a street fight with dismounts. But he also was determined not to lose an Abrams. It would be humiliating to have to leave it for the Iraqis, who would certainly haul out foreign TV crews to film a destroyed American tank. He was willing to give the crew a reasonable amount of time to get the fire out and have the tank towed. Schwartz decided to take advantage of the delay by ordering his crews to reload. They had expended an astonishing amount of ammunition. They'd been shooting nonstop since crossing the checkpoint. Some of the 50-caliber barrels were so hot that they were unable to fire, so the crews replaced them with fresh barrels. Schwartz had half the tanks and Bradleys reload and rearm, while the other half continued to lay down fire to keep the bunkers and snipers suppressed. The column was much easier to hit while it was stopped. 70 meters behind the burning tank, the brigade commander, Colonel Perkins, was in the open hatch of an M113, an armored personnel carrier. His driver had stopped under the overpass, but Perkins ordered him to move back onto the open highway. He didn't want to expose them to anyone hiding on the bridge. A Bradley behind him also pulled back to get a better firing angle on the overpass and to cover the brigade commander's back. Like Schwartz, Perkins did not want to leave an Abrams in the hands of the enemy. The tankers had a code. You don't leave your crew behind, and you don't abandon your tank. They were like ship captains. They were willing to go down with their ship. So far, the crew of Charlie 1-2 was doing all the right things, performing the evacuation and recovery drill just as they had been trained. Perkins was willing to give them a little more time. After Diaz had expended his tank's handheld extinguishers, the order went out for the other tanks to donate their extinguishers. Crewmen hopped out of the hatches, exposing themselves to fire, and delivered armloads of the red extinguishers. Diaz and his crew sprayed the flames. They smoldered, shot back up, and smoldered again. On Lieutenant Grunheisen's tank, Sergeant Hernandez wanted to fire the main gun into the troublesome bunker, but the lieutenant thought they were too close to Diaz's crew on the ground. The men were stressed enough without the concussive blast of a 120-millimeter round knocking them off their feet. Hernandez was desperate to help. He'd made a pact with Charlie 1-2's gunner, Sergeant Jose Couvertier. They would always watch each other's backs. Hernandez had taught the fire evacuation drill in Kuwait, so he asked Grunizen if he could go help. Grunizen hesitated. Their tank would be the tow tank once the fire was out, and he would need help. But after a long pause, Grunizen finally said he could handle the tank alone for the moment. Hernandez climbed down onto the highway. He was just now getting his first good look at his surroundings. He had seen nothing but desert on the march up from Kuwait, but now he was suddenly in a dense urban area. He was surprised to see homes and apartment buildings and shops. For the first time, he realized that Iraq, at least this part of it, was a modern 21st century nation with superhighways and late model cars and congested suburban sprawl. "Oh, shit," he yelled up to the lieutenant. "We're in an actual city." He felt hemmed in, claustrophobic. Hernandez climbed up onto Charlie 1-2 and helped Diaz get the V-packs out. Because the filter packs were burning so furiously, Diaz thought they could rob the fire of fuel by removing them. Hernandez reached down and grabbed one by its heavy aluminum frame. It burned his hand. He cursed and dropped it. Somebody doused it with water from a 5-gallon jug. Hernandez and Diaz reached back down and struggled to lift the packs. They were melted and fused together by the heat. Hernandez pounded them with a hammer, broke them apart, and he and Diaz and others lifted them out. With the V-packs removed, the fire settled down. Lieutenant Grunizen backed up his tank to the crippled tank so that his crewman could hook up the tow bar. Grunizen thought they were almost out of the predicament. It wasn't so bad. Even while towing another tank, his own tank could still fire, so they wouldn't be out of the fight. But as soon as the tow bar was connected, the fire erupted again. While the crew unhooked the tow bar, Hernandez got into the fight. He had left his 9mm pistol on his tank, so he picked up an M4 rifle someone had left on top of Charlie 1-2. He fired at the distant bunker, emptying the clip. He yelled at a sergeant who had just pulled up in an armored personnel carrier to assist with the evacuation. "You got another mag?" The sergeant offered Hernandez an ammunition magazine. But first he demanded Hernandez's empty magazine for accountability. They were supposed to account for their used magazines and turn them in. "I can't fucking believe you asked me that," Hernandez screamed. They were in the brigade's worst firefight of the whole war. An Abrams was on fire, and this guy was worried about turning in a used ammo magazine. But the sergeant insisted. Hernandez had to climb down into the turret where he tossed the empty magazine and fish it out. He handed it over, slammed in the new magazine, and went back to shooting. On top of the burning tank, Diaz was out of fire extinguishers. He had pumped about 2 dozen of them onto the fire, which was stubbornly refusing to die out for more than a few seconds at a time. Then the order went out for the tank crews to give up their 5-gallon water jugs. So the crewmen ran through the firefight again, lugging the heavy jugs toward Charlie 1-2. Diaz knew they had reached the point of desperation now. If the Halon and the fire extinguishers couldn't kill the fire, why would water be any more successful? It was getting preposterous now. The battalion's executive officer, Major Rick Nucio, was up on Diaz's tank trying to help. Nucio was the number 2 man in the whole battalion, behind Lieutenant Colonel Schwartz. Yet here he was, getting his eyebrows burned off while helping to pull out the smoking V-packs, dumping a 5-gallon jug on a raging fuel fire, standing on a burning tank in the middle of a firefight. The company commander, Captain Conroy, was worried that the situation was getting out of control. When he gave the order for water jugs, for instance, he hadn't meant for the crews to remain on the ground after delivering the water. He had to order them to get back inside the tanks for cover. Conroy's tank was in front of the burning tank, providing cover fire while giving Lieutenant Colonel Schwartz a blow-by-blow account over the radio. Schwartz was under pressure from Colonel Perkins to resolve the situation, and that pressure was bearing down now on Conroy. He was a smooth-faced 29-year-old veteran from upstate New York, an energetic and enthusiastic commander. Despite the pressure, he played for time. He knew they couldn't keep the column waiting much longer, but he wanted to give the crew every opportunity to save the tank. But Conroy was getting conflicting reports from Lieutenant Grunizen. First the fire was out, then it was back, then it was out again. At one point, Conroy had just told Rogue Six, Schwartz, that the fire had been extinguished and they were hooking up the tow bar. Then Grunizen radioed and told Conroy, "It's on fire again."
"What do you mean it's on fire? I thought you were putting it out."
"I know," Grunizen said, "but it caught back on fire." Conroy felt a little ridiculous, updating Schwartz with a situation report that reversed itself every other minute. Grunizen was getting frustrated, too. He felt the captain was sharpshooting him, trying to instruct him on how to fight a tank fire, even though he was following the drill to the letter. Hell, his man Hernandez had taught the fire evacuation course. Colonel Perkins was growing impatient. Not only was the entire column stopped and exposed, but the time lag in radio reports was also confusing everybody. It was one of the hazards of combat. Radio updates often were outdated at the moment they were issued. From the hatch of his armored personnel carrier stopped on the highway, Perkins was in a position to see the flames, yet he kept getting radio reports from Captain Conroy, relayed to him by Major Nucio, that the tank fire had been put out, yet he could plainly see that Charlie 1-2 was still on fire. Then the first suicide vehicle appeared. Conroy saw it, a blue truck hurtling down the on-ramp in front of him. He ordered a machine gun round fired into the engine block as a warning. The round tore into the truck and the vehicle screeched to a halt. The driver, a man in civilian clothes, stumbled out and put his hands up. Behind him, gunmen in one of the bunkers opened fire. Conroy motioned wildly at the driver to get down. The tanks couldn't fire on the bunker without hitting him. The man dropped down on his belly, and one of the tanks fired a main gun round into the bunker. It exploded. Five soldiers emerged from the wreckage, running at the tanks, firing assault rifles. A burst of coax splattered them across the roadway. Now a white pickup was roaring across the bridge and heading for the on-ramp. At the foot of the ramp, Conroy ordered his gunner to traverse and fire. The gunner yelled that the hydraulic power had suddenly gone out. He was trying to traverse the main gun with a manual crank. Conroy picked up his M4 carbine just in case, then radioed a Bradley next to him. "Hey, there's a suicide truck coming down." The Bradley commander picked it up right away. The truck turned sharply and picked up speed, racing down the ramp. Conroy could see three men inside. One in uniform, one in civilian clothes, and squeezed between them a young man wearing a white headband with black Arabic script. They weren't slowing down. They were aiming for Conroy's tank. The Bradley opened up. From his hatch, Grunizen pumped away with the .50 caliber. Everybody was unloading. Coax, 25-millimeter guns. They couldn't stop it. They kept firing. Finally, the pickup shuddered, bounced crazily down the ramp, and slammed into a guardrail a few meters from Conroy's tank. Conroy could see something piled in the pickup bed. He was afraid it was explosives, so he screamed into the radio net for everyone to hold their fire. Then he saw the young man in the headband moving. The other tank crew saw him too, and everyone thought the same thing. He might be reaching for a remote device to trigger a truck bomb. Conroy gave the order to fire. Round slammed into the pickup. It caught fire, and the man in the headband was burned alive. Behind Conroy, everyone was furiously pouring water onto the fire inside Charlie 1-2, with little success. The burning tank had now consumed nearly 30 minutes of precious time, and the level of fire from both sides of the highway was intensifying. Iraqi military trucks were pouring in from the city, dropping off dismounts. Diaz began to resign himself to losing his tank. He hated the thought of it, but he hated even more the thought of losing one of his men in a futile attempt to put out a fuel fire. The fuel had leaked into the turret by now, and the fire was spreading. Everyone decided not to try to tow the tank for fear that the ammunition loaded inside would detonate, threatening the towing tank. Diaz had the crew unload the tank, yanking off sensitive items like radios and code boxes and combat manuals. They piled the stuff, along with their rucksacks and weapons, on top of Grunison's tank and inside an armored personnel carrier commanded by the company first sergeant. Grunison had been pleading with Conroy for just a little more time, and Conroy had been asking Schwartz, who had been asking Perkins. But now, Perkins had heard enough. They couldn't stay exposed any longer. The entire battalion was at risk, not just one tank. It was time to cut their losses. Perkins ordered that the crew prepare to abandon the tank. Charlie 1-2 would have to be left to fall into enemy hands. Diaz heard the order. Despite himself, he agreed with it. It was the right thing to do, given the circumstances. Now, after struggling for so long to save the tank, the crew thought they had to destroy it. They'd been trained to destroy any abandoned equipment to keep it from falling into the hands of the enemy. In this case, they certainly didn't want the Iraqis to recover anything from a late-model Abrams tank. It was decided that Hernandez would try to burn it with thermite grenades, incendiary grenades filled with aluminum powder and metal oxide. After the crew had abandoned the tank, Hernandez threw open the ammunition doors to expose the main gun rounds and the ammunition for the coax and 50 caliber machine guns. He cut the fuel lines and turned on the heater. He knew the drill. He had taught the fire evacuation course. He scattered 50 caliber ammunition across the floor of the turret and stuffed a few rounds inside the gun breech. Then he sprayed everything with lubricating oil from the tank's toolbox. The rest of the crew finished loading gear and weapons onto other vehicles. Diaz hauled himself up to the loader's hatch of Lieutenant Grunison's tank, followed by Diaz's gunner, Sergeant Couvertier, who took Hernandez's spot in the gunner's mount. Private First Class Schaefer, Grunison's loader, jumped into the First Sergeant's personnel carrier along with Private First Class Shipley, the driver from the burning tank. The order came over the radio to pull out. Colonel Perkins wanted the column back on the move right away, but he didn't want the tank destroyed. He planned to try to recover it in the next couple of days. He wasn't aware that the crewmen, following the dictates of their training, believed they were supposed to burn it so that nothing could be recovered by the enemy. On top of the stricken tank, Hernandez had on his CVC helmet, his radio helmet, but he had no communications. He was on his own now. He was concerned about hustling back to his tank and getting away from the blast before the thermite grenade set off all the ammo and fuel. He was also waving to get the attention of the drivers of two armored personnel carriers behind him, trying to tell them to get out of the way because he was about to blow the tank. Finally, in frustration, he motioned furiously and showed them the thermite grenades. Perkins, meanwhile, was getting irritated by the delay. He'd ordered the tank abandoned. What was taking so long? He had his driver pull up to the burning tank so he could find out what was holding everybody up. He saw Hernandez up top, clutching a couple of primed thermite grenades. "Get off the tank, now!" Perkins yelled. Hernandez was shocked. No one had ever heard Perkins raise his voice. He was a calm, controlled commander with a dead-level demeanor. Now his face was flushed and the veins in his neck were pumping.
"Leave the tank! Get your crew! Get off! Let's move on!"
Perkins yelled again. Hernandez took that as an order to blow the tank. He pulled the pin on the first grenade, lifted his fingers off the spoon, the cocked handle, and flipped it into the breech. He popped the second grenade and dropped it down onto the turret floor. The grenades hissed and smoldered for several seconds, giving Hernandez time to clamber off Charlie 1-2 and hustle back to his own tank, creeping death. He climbed aboard and saw that his friend Couvertier, the gunner from the burning tank, was now in Hernandez's post in the gunner's mount. Couvertier offered to move, but Hernandez told him to stay there. Diaz was in the loader's hatch, so Hernandez half sat and half lay on the top of the tank, next to the haphazard pile of gear and weapons from the burning tank, in front of Diaz and to the left of Grunheisen. There were now 5 men on a tank designed for 4. The driver, Sergeant Derek Peterson, got the tank moving. It was urgent now. The rest of the column had already moved out, and the burning tank was about to blow. Flames were spitting out of the tank commander's hatch, where Hernandez had tossed the grenades. But their overloaded tank was blocked now by an engineer vehicle that had stopped in the roadway. Diaz screamed at the engineers, "Move out! Move out! The tank's about to blow!" The engineers, alarmed, gunned their engine and sped away. Creeping Death, with Hernandez exposed beside the cupola, was pulling up to the tail of the column when a series of muffled explosions rocked the abandoned tank. Diaz looked back and saw the glow of the flames. He felt heartsick. He had been with Charlie 1-2 since arriving in Kuwait 6 months earlier. It was like losing a member of his family. Behind them, Lieutenant Shane Williams was commanding Crusader 2, the trail tank in the column. He could see that Charlie 1-2 was still intact, despite the fire and the thermite grenades. He decided to put a heat round into the tank to make sure there was nothing left for the Iraqis. Williams was a 33-year-old combat veteran, a slender, light-haired Floridian who had served as a cavalry scout in the first Gulf War. He waited until the other vehicles had cleared out, then ordered his gunner to unleash a round. It hit just over the driver's hatch. Charlie 1-2 shuddered and rocked. Williams thought to himself, "I'm now the only tank commander in the entire U.S. Army who has killed an Abrams M1A1 tank. How was that going to look on his resume?" On Creeping Death, Grunheisen was struggling to catch up to the rest of the column. The crew had piled all the gear and rucksacks and extra weapons right in his field of vision. The stuff was like a little mountain in front of his face. He could see to fire the 50 caliber off to his right flank, and he could see behind him and off to his left. But in front of him, all he saw was gear and rucksacks. He was under fire, on an unfamiliar highway, trying to catch up to an armored column, and he couldn't see a damn thing. Chapter 3. Double Tap. At the head of the rogue column, Lieutenant Ball was relieved to be on the move again. Like everyone else in the battalion, he had spent the 30-minute wait on Highway 8 fighting to keep enemy dismounts away from his platoon's tanks. He found it hard to believe, but a couple of Iraqi soldiers had actually tried to charge the Abrams on foot. What were they thinking? Ball tried popping off a few rounds from his M4, but he wasn't quite capable of the acrobatics required to fire a carbine accurately while talking on the radio and maneuvering his tank. His wingman, the gunner in the tank behind him, took care of the dismounts with a blast of coax. But Ball couldn't stop worrying about some Iraqi fanatic sneaking up his rear end and tossing a grenade into the hatch. Ball felt much better now that they were back on track and heading for the airport, even though the delay had given the Fedayeen and the Syrian street fighters time to regroup. Ball could see men with weapons jumping off of trucks that were now arriving from the city and from the increasingly congested warrens of houses and commercial buildings along the divided roadway. Air Force pilots, circling far above the battle, were warning the battalion's air liaison officer that more vehicles were on their way from the city center. The pilots were warning, too, about a collection of anti-aircraft guns in a grove of date palm trees just off the highway, what they called AAA Park for anti-aircraft artillery. The Iraqis had leveled some of the guns and shot them in direct fire mode, aiming directly at the tanks and Bradleys. The rogue crews could hear 8-10 Thunderbolt II planes pounding away on the anti-aircraft batteries, their 30-millimeter Gatling guns emitting low groans that echoed across the landscape. Highway 8 was taking Ball closer to the city center now, and the traffic patterns were becoming more complex and confusing. Ball studied the military map pinned to his hatch, checking the coordinates against his plugger, his handheld global positioning satellite device. He saw highway signs warning of upcoming exits, but his map didn't show exit numbers or the names of major highways or neighborhoods. Even so, he was thankful that someone in the Baghdad Roads Department had thought to post huge blue highway signs that read, in Arabic and English, Airport. His company commander, Captain Andy Hilmes, had told Ball to look for the signs. Enemy fire was intensifying as they drew near the city center. Some of the fighters near the roadside bunkers and trenches were trying something new. They would lie next to the ditches, pretending to be dead. After the tanks had passed, they would leap up, aim an RPG tube, and fire grenades at the rear of the tanks. The soldier who had taken out Charlie 1-2 may have just gotten off a lucky shot, but he also may have known about the tank's vulnerable rear engine grills. And if he did, then some of these fighters probably did too. From the commander's hatch of his Bradley, Captain Larry Burris, the commander of a mechanized infantry company attached to Rogue, spotted two Iraqi fighters in the median. One was waving a white rag, and the other had hoisted a white plastic chair over his head. They were making wild, don't-shoot gestures. Burris let them go. But just after he passed them, the two men picked up weapons and opened fire on Burris's trail platoon. The platoon returned fire and killed them. But Burris realized he now had one more complication to deal with. One of his men already had taken a piece of shrapnel to the face from an exploding enemy truck, and Burris's crews were struggling to tell the difference between civilian cars and military vehicles. He thought his men were showing restraint, holding their fire and waving away errant civilians or firing warning shots. But now they had to deal with gunmen in civilian clothes pretending to surrender. Burris was determined to bring all 160 men in his company back home alive. He realized that the enemy tactics were putting both Iraqi civilians and American soldiers at risk, and that angered him. Over the net, other commanders were complaining about the phony dead men rising up and firing weapons. They wanted permission to make sure people who appeared to be dead really were dead. Lieutenant Colonel Schwartz had heard enough. He got on the net and ordered his men to double-tap. "Anything you see," he instructed, "don't assume it's dead. Double-tap it. Shoot it again, especially anyone near a weapon." Schwartz wanted them to check their work. At the rear of the column, Lieutenant Shane Williams, who had put the kill shot into Charlie 1-2, would do the final check, making sure no threats with weapons survived. He would execute the final double taps. At one point, one of the tanks lit up a truck that was unloading dismounts. The soldiers were torn apart like butchered hogs, and their remains lay in smoking heaps. In the middle of the mess sat a soldier who at first appeared to be dead but was now moving. He was reaching for an RPG launcher. Captain Conroy spotted him, but the hydraulic system on his tank was still malfunctioning. His gunner couldn't traverse his main gun and coax. Conroy got on the radio to the Bradley behind him and said, "There's a guy with an RPG," and he indicated the spot. The Bradley opened up with coax, but Conroy couldn't tell if the man had been hit. A gunner on one of the tanks saw him moving, so he opened up with his coax. The soldier was rocking back and forth now, still reaching for the RPG tube. "Would you please kill this guy?" Conroy said. The soldier was still rocking when the Bradley hit him with a blast of 25 Mike-Mike, the 25-millimeter Bushmaster chain gun. The man's body blew apart. Nobody worried anymore about the guy playing dead. On the west side of the highway, Schwartz noticed a series of flower shops and greenhouses. It looked like one of those nurseries commonly seen on highways outside American suburbs. There were drooping awnings, perennials in big plastic pots and trays of annuals, shrubs and hanging baskets, and sheets of plastic blotting out the hot April sun. Behind the plants were rows of heavy clay pots, and behind them were men with automatic rifles and RPGs, crouching and hiding, apparently in the mistaken belief that a half inch of baked clay and a few pounds of dirt would shield them from coax rounds or 25 Mike-Mike. They were all reloading, having pelted the front of the column. Now they were setting up to unload on Schwartz and his vehicles. Schwartz was amazed. The gunmen appeared to have no idea how vulnerable they had left themselves. Schwartz yelled to his gunner, "Spray some ammunition in there." That would get their attention, Schwartz thought. It would keep their heads down until the Bradley gunners behind Schwartz could get a fix on them. Schwartz radioed the Bradley commanders. "There's a florist, a nursery coming up on your left. Destroy that nursery." The Bradleys obeyed. Schwartz watched the clay pots explode right down the row one by one. 25 Mike-Mike is a high-explosive round. It hits and pops. The clay pots disappeared. And so did the men behind them. They evaporated in a spray of dirt and clay, their weapons flying. Four of the Bradleys went at it, killing a few, then passing the targets back to the next Bradley, which killed a few and passed the work back. They were finishing their work. They put perhaps 100 rounds of 25 Mike-Mike into the nursery, and then it was gone. And a couple dozen fighters, more or less, were gone too. "Okay, you're done," Schwartz said. "Shut it off." The 25-millimeter gun tube swung back north, and the Bradleys plowed forward, the gunners searching through their thermal sights for more targets. The enemy kept coming. Soldiers and civilian gunmen were arriving now in every available mode of transportation. Hatchbacks, orange and white taxis, police cars, ambulances, pickups, big Chevys, motorcycles with sidecars. Major Nucio, the battalion executive officer, opened fire on a huge garbage truck with a soldier at the wheel. He was thinking to himself as the soldier keeled over and the truck crash-landed, "A garbage truck? These people are so stupid." Stupid, but determined. They were not giving up. It seemed suicidal. Men with nothing more than AK-47s or wildly inaccurate RPGs were charging tanks and Bradleys. It was like they wanted to die. Or worse, they just didn't care. That disturbed some of the tankers. They weren't trained to fight people who didn't give a damn, nor were they quite prepared to fight people who didn't have a plan, didn't have a clue. As each RPG team or pack of dismounts attacked with utter disregard for what the other Iraqis or Syrians were doing, the tankers kept thinking, it's all a big trap. They really do have a plan. They're just luring us in with these haphazard, disjointed tactics. Sometime soon, they're going to get organized and attack with some serious tactics. At one point, a little white Volkswagen Passat suddenly appeared on the highway. It came off one of the access ramps. Before anyone could react, the Passat turned sharply and smacked into one of the Bradleys. Everyone thought it was a suicide car, but nothing exploded. The driver opened the door and stepped out, his hands raised over his head. He was a portly, middle-aged man with a trim black mustache and wavy silver hair. He wore an Iraqi military uniform with a colonel's gold rank on his epaulets. There was a pistol on his hip. The Bradley commander radioed Captain Hilmes.
"Sir, we got an Iraqi general here," he said,
misreading the colonel's rank.
"He just crashed his car into our Bradley. What do you want us to do with him?"
"Capture his ass," Hilmes ordered.
Several infantrymen climbed out of the Bradley's hull and snatched the colonel and dragged him inside. Later, under interrogation by U.S. military interpreters, the Iraqi said he was the military quartermaster for all of Baghdad. He was a brown shoes guy, a desk officer. He'd been driving to work, minding his own business. And suddenly, he was involved in a fender bender with an American Bradley fighting vehicle. He told his interrogators that he'd had no idea American forces were in Baghdad. From what he'd been hearing on government-controlled radio, American forces had been stopped cold below the Euphrates River, well south of the capital. He certainly never expected to see tanks in Baghdad. Every officer he knew was convinced the Americans were afraid to bring tanks into a city. It was baffling. Senior Iraqi officers in the capital seemed content to believe their own lies, that the war was going well, and the Americans were bogged down south of the city. Even many ordinary civilians seemed unaware that there was a war going on. Despite the columns of black smoke from burning vehicles and the thunderous pounding of the tanks and the Bradleys, civilians in family sedans were coasting down the southbound lanes of Highway 8 and along the access roads, like it was just another Saturday morning in the suburbs. For all they knew from listening to government radio, the war was confined to the southern desert, where American forces were being routed. It was only the Fedayeen and Syrians and unknown numbers of special Republican guards who seemed to understand that American forces were invading the capital. And if these soldiers and fighters and militiamen were disorganized and poorly trained, they didn't lack for determination or gall, and there seemed to be an endless supply of weapons and ammunition, and of gunmen eager to fight and die.